Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to join you again. We first did an imagination program last year. It's interesting to take stock of the passage of time, just 12 months, and what has changed. And I also want to note with some pleasure this notion of imagination. I'm put in mind of a quote from Albert Einstein. He said that imagination is more important than knowledge. That was a man who was a scientist, after all. Science, simply another word for knowledge. He understood the importance of research, understood the importance of learning. And so I think that's why we come to Publishing University. Although, when I think about why I came to college many years ago, it was for other reasons, of course. But last year, devices was the subject at hand. And that was for good reason. At that point, we were only 1 month into the iPad era. And in the time since then, we've seen more than 15 million of that famous tablet sold, something that seemed to really be the tipping point in bringing the e-book revolution to pass. But I'd like to point out that if 15 million iPads are sold, that's 5% of the American public with such a device. 95% remain without it. So why all the rush? The last time we had a revolution of this kind was the emergence of the printing press in the end of the 15th century. It took 150 years for anything like a publishing business to emerge. So while it's possible to invent a technology, inventing a business takes a good deal more work. But of course, the reason we are here is because of what's happening. This is not the Middle Ages, after all, and we don't have centuries to work these things out. These things happen at lightning speed because of the technologies. The AAP has just released some numbers regarding book sales for January and February of 2010, the most recent numbers available. What they found was what they called triple-digit percentage growth. There's a lot behind that phrase, triple-digit percentage growth. But what you should know is, since February 2009 to February 2010, e-book sales rose 202%. E-books today are the number one format among all categories of trade publishing, according to AAP. And this was in February. This may flatten out some, but in February, this is an interesting phrase, an interesting thought, all those e-book sales were attributed to something they called loading, which is the fact that lots of people around holiday time got a tablet of some kind, a Kindle, a Nook, or an iPad, and they had to put something into it. But the dollar figures are also important to cite. Year-to-date sales, so for January and February of e-books, were $164 million. For all those other trade categories, $441 million. And that figure in the trade print side was down 25%. So we're here today to understand about e-reading. How is the e-reading experience, how are e-reading purchasing patterns going to affect everyone in this room over the next 12 months? So we have a great panel to chat with, and I'd like to get started first with James Howard. James, welcome. James is Director of Publishing Services at R.R. Belker, and he oversees the client relationship of a host of Belker business intelligence services, including PubTrack, the consumer research panel that reaches annually over 40,000 E and P book consumers. He's been involved in quite a lot of research in that work, and so comes here with what I think we all need, which is some sobering numbers, some real facts behind the hype. So, James, let's start by asking, what does your research tell us who the e-book buyer is and what kind of preferences they have?
Okay. Before we get to that question, I just want to give you a reason why I'm actually here and how I got into the business intelligence sector for Belker. I used to work for Nielsen. I used to work for Nielsen BookScan, and I used to know everything about point of sale and why point of sale numbers are very much important for publishers to understand their market. You only have to go back 5-6 years ago, where it was relatively easier for you guys to publish a book, find a store, place that book in the store, and then watch the sales. Nowadays, a consumer can pick up a book right now, download it, buy it, anywhere they are, anywhere in the world. And unfortunately, no true industry is reporting those sales to collect exactly how your e-books are selling. So the only way that we can understand what's going on in the mind of the consumer is by asking the consumer. Now, in the business that I look after, we track two markets, the higher education market and the Christian book market, from a point of sale perspective. So we know what's going on in those markets. But in order to really understand beyond the numbers, you have to go back to the consumer and ask them why they're doing what they're doing, where are they shopping, why have they become aware of your products, etc., etc. So we do that on a regular basis. In fact, this year we're tracking 6,000 unique book consumers every month. We teamed up with BISG to look at the e-book buyer and really focus in on who they are, what they're doing, why they're doing. So right now, in March, we have a e-book market share of about 15%. Now, when we say 15%, we say 15% of the entire market. So that's new used books, that's college books, that's academic, that's fiction, non-fiction, children's, religion, through any channel. Because we can ask the consumer where they've purchased their books, and they can tell us Barnes & Noble, Street Vendor, Book Club, wherever they purchased that book. So right now in March, to answer your question, the e-book buyer right now is predominantly female. I think sort of over the age of 45, middle to high income, and, it's growing substantially.
Well, you mentioned the challenge of tracking all these numbers. Let's dive a little bit deeper into some of the numbers. And I'm curious, too, because you also follow the market in the UK. Are there any interesting comparison points there that you'd like to share with us?
I think in the UK, the UK is slightly behind the e-book curve, in a sense that in the US, free is, 50% of e-books are purchased as free. In the UK, it's actually slightly higher than that. It's almost up to 70% of the books are free, so slightly behind the curve.
So I hope everybody heard that. So over 50% of e-books purchased are free. You have some other interesting numbers regarding pricing and particularly the comparison with other book forms, if you will, formats. I think the hardcover was $16.
That's right.
And the ebook goes down to?
It's about $6.
$6, right. And you also found out that there is some lifestyle issues that are occurring here, I believe. You said that you are also tracking the hours that are spent and how people relate to other mediums.
That's right. I don't have those figures with me, Chris, but we do that on a regular basis. And again, it's all about understanding the consumer. I challenge all of my client base, publishers, authors, retailers. If you had, 1,000 ebook buyers in front of you, what questions would you be asking? And that's the key of consumer research for the publishing trade right now.
Right. And with regard to the number around women, that they are the predominant share of the market, 60-40 roughly, mm-hmm. What you have found, and that may be expected because up to now the e-book marketplace has been dominated by genre fiction.
Right.
And they are very much fans of certain types of genre fiction. But this is now moving beyond fiction.
That's right. Some of the non-fiction categories, business, self-help, all have 15 to 20% market share in terms of units. And again, the key is identifying that segment that's buying that format within that genre.
Right. And give us a sense of how quickly this is happening. As I mentioned, this isn't the Middle Ages. We don't have all the time in the world.
Right. Of course.
In May of 2009, roughly two publishing universities ago, the share of e-books was about 3%.
Correct.
So where are we today, then?
Is it
15%?
15% right now.
Right. But it was 4% only last year.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really and a very accelerating curve.
Yeah.
As you continue to track this, what are some kinds of questions that you're going to be wanting to really get the answers to and dig into over the next year?
I think, it's all about awareness. One of the things that we have to realize right now is that, bookstores hold in excess of 50, 60,000 titles to browse through. Today's ebook buyer is going online and probably seeing, 50, 60 titles in front of them. There's not that browsing discovery capability just yet. And I think, we've got to try and understand what's going on in that market. And again, I keep saying it, but, not everyone is buying an ebook. There are still, major areas like, let's say, graphic novels, where 70% of the books purchased are trade paperback. So, you know, it's about understanding each one of those customers and why they do what they do.
And I think that's heartening news. I mean, we are often attending these kinds of conferences that are called something about the future of publishing, and I've begun to think that the future of publishing is conferences about the future of publishing. We hear at those conferences that the book is dead, that we had a debate just a few moments ago that said publishers are irrelevant, but it doesn't sound at all like you're going along with that yet.
No, definitely not.
All right. Well, I think it's a good place to turn now to Amy Greco. Amy, welcome.
Hi.
Amy is senior manager of vendor relations in the U.S. for Kobo eBooks. She's also a founder of BookCamp NYC and Unconference for publishing types and readers. That would be something worth checking out, I'm sure. And Amy comes to us to tell us about the point that James was making about how the consumer is getting their book. And I guess we should start, first of all, by letting you give us the Kobo pitch very briefly. What is it that Kobo does here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a very top-level pitch for us is that we are a global ebook retailer and an e-reading platform. So we sell ebooks in every country in the globe, around the globe. Excuse me, I'm on a lot of allergy medicine, so if I start talking in Klingon, just give a hand up. we're also an e-reading platform, which means that we have our own e-ink reader, the Kobo reader. We also have applications for a number of tablet devices and smartphones, so Android, BlackBerry, iOS, of course. The idea is e-reading anytime, anywhere. Wherever you want to read your e-books, we want to have an app for that. We want to enable you to be able to read them there.
Right, and so with that technology, of course, comes the capacity to track all this, as James was starting to tell us. Share with us some numbers, perhaps comparisons between the e-ink readers and the tablet readers, and just otherwise, what are some things you've learned by being able to kind of get inside the reader's habits?
Absolutely. Kobo's a very young company. We're over a year old. We were a year in December. And we are very beholden to our analytics. Literally, when you go into the Kobo offices, there are giant television screens above each department tracking sales today, how they did compared to yesterday, how they did compared to the month before, how our marketing promotions are tracking. We have daily meetings to look at the numbers and say, we're down in Android, what did we do? Do we need to do a marketing campaign there? So, we really believe in looking at where the sales are happening and turning up the volume as necessary to keep those sales happening. We obviously look at our consumers as well. So we spend a lot of time looking at, what happens when someone purchases primarily on an iPad versus somebody who purchases primarily on an e-reader. And of course, we've noticed that the e-ink reader, is really just a reading machine. It's generally skews more female for us. Buys about 7 books a month. We separate our buyers into cohorts, so we have gold, silver, bronze. E-ink readers are all firmly in the gold cohort, which means they spend more money than anybody else at our company. When you look at iPad readers, it changes a little bit. That tends to skew a little bit more male. They're still great customers for us. We love to have them. But they sink into our silver cohort. What's interesting is that while e-ink readers tend to be more genre, as we were talking about earlier, they read a lot of romance, they read a lot of thriller, they read a lot of erotica. What we see on the iPad is actually a little bit of extension into those nonfiction markets. So I think as we talk about what people are buying, we need to talk about the devices that they have to purchase them on. In 2009, you just didn't have this kind of this reader to be able to look at a chart effectively, to be able to resize your images and all of those kinds of things.
Right. And you've done some work with sharing of content, which is to some publishers perhaps a kind of a danger zone. But you found a way to begin to share content through Facebook, and that has yielded some interesting results. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So, I think discoverability is number one on everyone's mind in the ebook space. It's true that a lot of people still find out about the new Stephen King novel by walking into Barnes & Noble and seeing it on the front counter or walking into their indie. So I think everybody is sort of thinking, how can we do this online? And is there a way to do it even better online when we can track what people are doing and how they're talking? So one of the initiatives that Kobo launched earlier this year is called Reading Life. It's a way for users to be rewarded when they read during certain times of day. We also enable sharing to Facebook. So a user can share when they start a new book. They can share when they finish a book. They're able to share very, very short passages, no longer than 140 characters, to Facebook. You know, we wanted to create a way for people to be able to communicate with their friends about what they're reading. What we've found, we launched it in December. Since that time, people who have enabled Facebook sharing on the app spend a total of 33% more time in app, which is enormous. And they spend that time reading. They're reading more because they like to talk about what they're reading, and they're getting sort of positive feedback from their friends on Facebook, we assume. So we're going to keep pushing this. We think this is a good space.
Well, that point about keeping people reading, it's about that elusive, immersive experience that everyone speaks about. When we were together here at Publishing University just last year, there was a lot of talk about so-called enhanced books, and a discussion ensued about when is a book not a book. You have some early results on just the popularity or not of the enhanced book experience.
Yeah, I mean, we're very beholden to our customers. We are a company of about 180 people, which is very small when you compare it to the 30,000 at Apple and at Amazon. So we need to be very strategic in what we decide to do. So we listen to our customers, and we want to hear what they have to say. I think to date, we have not yet had a request for video in a book. We have not yet had a request for audio in a book. You know, what we do get requests for a lot are proper formatting in the ebook, good division of chapters for better pricing in ebooks. So this is what we're seeing customers care about. This is what we're hearing from our customers. So we're sort of taking a wait and see approach to what people are calling enhanced content. That's not to say that somebody won't come out with a phenomenal version of enhanced content. I always worry about the concept of jamming these sort of things into books, right? And there's obviously people who are very talented editors who can do it really beautifully. I think Ron will probably talk about what Electric Literature is doing, which I think is very smart. But I do, you don't want this additional stuff to sort of turn into that paperclip that used to be in Microsoft, right? Remember that? Like, looks like you're writing a letter. It looks like you're reading an ebook. Like, you really want it to be seamless, and you want it to be, I think, an enhancement to the reading experience as opposed to something that takes away from it. And to me, I think it's very important that it all be incredibly author-driven. You know, I hate the idea of a poor author going into a publisher and having them say, well, this is great, but we're going to need you to record like 7 videos for it, and just having that experience feel very disjointed. And, I call them Franken novels, like everything just sort of sewn together. So, that's a lot of personal opinion. certainly people at Kobo feel differently.
I'm going to guess it's probably shared by a few people here. Kobo does also allow for publishers to experiment, which I think is critical. I was talking about Einstein before and this notion, if I knew what I was doing, I wouldn't call it research. Right now, we are still in very much the research mode. We haven't come to any conclusions. If we were in a laboratory, we would still be, pouring things into test tubes. What are some ways that publishers have used the Kobo platform to do that kind of experimentation?
Yeah, I mean, I think where we're seeing the most experimentation and the most sort of data is in the pricing, in the area of pricing. My boss is fond of saying that we're sort of ending the first era of ebook selling and we're moving into the second. We have solid years of data to look at right now, and we have solid ways to track what people are buying and how they're buying. So I think what's really interesting is talking about free ebooks and saying that that percentage is going down in the U.S. I think when this first started, we saw a lot of people experimenting with free. They wanted to put it out there for free. Let's just get people reading. What I love and what we try to encourage at Kobo is let's do cheap instead of free. Let's do 99 cents. Let's do $1.99. Let's train the customer to put his or her credit card into the machine, and let's train them to pay for content. So I think we're seeing a real sweet spot right now around $2.99 to 99 cents. And another interesting thing that we've been noticing is that occasionally an author with a fan base who is maybe self-publishing or putting stuff out there less expensively, we're actually seeing sales spikes around $4.99. And the theory on that right now is that customers are getting used to these inexpensive ebooks, and they're starting to realize that a price point a little bit higher means things like maybe an editor has looked at the work, or maybe I know, right? Maybe some time has been spent on the formatting, making it look great. So experimenting with pricing, I think, is a really great way to get to know your customer better, and a really great way to figure out where you can hit that sweet spot.
Right, and Amy, finally, it's not just around pricing that the experimentation is possible. This is fascinating. fascinating to me. You can start to play with things like covers and titles in a way that simply weren't possible in the physical world.
And I think that's fascinating, too. I mean, we're getting people really thinking, okay, so this looks great on a shelf in your local bookstore, but does it look great on a shelf in your iPad? You know, does it look great in an e-bookstore? How do we make the font big enough so you can actually read the author's name? You know, if it's got 1,000 little pictures of cakes, maybe you need to just put one big picture of cake on there. So, I mean, it's an interesting way of thinking. Certainly, we have years and years of tradition for building book covers that sell in a physical space, and I think we need to start thinking about what will a book cover look like to sell in a digital space. And certainly with ebooks, you have a lot of chances for experimenting with that.
Well, I think that's a great place to now turn to Ron Hogan. Thank you, Amy. Amy Greco from Kobo. And Ron Hogan, welcome. You're here today in place of Andy Hunter from Electric Literature, who, you know, just rather like the book business, had an unexpected sort of change in plans.
He knew it was coming. He had 9 months to prepare.
Oh, okay. Well, at the very last minute, though, something came up. So that's why Andy can't be here today. But Ron is actually, I think, obviously quite qualified to talk to us today. He is the proprietor of Beatrice.com. He's a contributor to Shelf Awareness. He is the former senior editor at Gallicat from Media Bistro. But right now also doing some work with Electric Literature as a project manager. And I think for everyone who's not familiar with that very interesting startup, which again, I mean, I first met Scott and Andy about a little bit more than a year and a half ago. They had made a big splash because they tried to publish a novel on Twitter. And it worked not so well.
Right, they had gotten, it was Rick Moody, right?
It was Rick Moody.
They had gotten Rick Moody to do a pretty good-sized story. And the deal was the Electric Literature Twitter feed was going to publish this Rick Moody story in 140-character bursts, many of which, but not uniformly so, worked effectively as tweets, as well as, you know, part of a larger context. The problem that led to the sort of like backlash reception was that a number of independent bookstores also signed up to sort of like, you know, co-publish this at the same time. And the resulting problem was that individual readers who might be subscribed to, you know, both Electric Literature and a local independent bookstore that was doing this, and maybe another, you know, independent bookstore with a national presence. Or, you know, so they were getting these tweets 3 or 4 times in their Twitter feeds. And a lot of people did, I mean, a lot by, you know, internet standards. So, yeah.
Seven.
And so, like, you know, the minute, one of the other things about internet culture is that the minute there's like 7 complaints, the experiment has failed. You know, everybody gets to say, oh, the experiment has failed. When it really, I don't think there was necessarily evidence that the experiment had failed. It was just a case of, you know, like you say, you're in the research period and you're sort of playing around and seeing, well, okay, now we have to figure out a way to make sure that people aren't, you know, seeing the story like more times than they need to.
Well, the experiment got them into the New York Times. So as experiments go, that's a pretty decent result. And in fact, just recently, they won an innovation award. And they've been doing quite a lot there with apps and with other ways of presenting ebooks. And I guess there may be some apathy right now in this crowd after a year in, worried about, well, my God, I have to publish books, and then I have to make them available with various ebook platforms, and now I have to do apps. But tell us from the perspective of Electric Literature, what are some bonuses that an ebook can offer that make it worthwhile, or I should say for an app, make it worthwhile for a publisher to develop?
Okay, well, let me backtrack a bit here to put it, kind of contextualize this. And, you know, when the Kindle first started gaining traction and as the iPad was looming, there was sort of this sentiment within the mainstream publishing industry that, these devices were, you know, there was a lot of hope placed on the idea that these devices would quote unquote save publishing, which kind of became, you know, as much a mocking term as it did a hope, really. But part of that was that there was sort of this Upper East Side fantasy that because the Kindle, I think part of it was that because the Kindle and the iPad were expensive devices, that the types of people who would be buying these devices would then be buying, you know, better books. So that, you know, that this was going to save literary fiction, basically, because if you could afford a Kindle, of course you were going to be a more sophisticated reader. In reality, as we have discussed, and you know, Randy pointed out brilliantly in the opening session, and as you've mentioned in your opening remarks, the ebook platform market pretty much mirrors the book market exactly. You know, there might be a few percentage points in various categories here and there, but the market of, you know, Kobo, Kindle, Nook, and the iBook Store, and these other, like, you know, widespread, you know, platform, whether it's a on the device or on a thing like the iPad, where it's a reading tool, that's the regular bookstore. And so, you know, if you're hoping to sort of like gain huge traction there, it's not necessarily going to happen the way you hope. What we do at Electric Publisher, which is basically taking Electric Literature's own app technology, which we created to sort of sell the original Electric Literature literary magazine in an online in an app format, is we've now taken that software and made it available to other publishers and said, you know, here is an opportunity for you to create a niche, a reading niche for yourself that is essentially direct to consumers, which as many of you who are independent niche publishers know, direct to consumer is key to sort of like aggregating that audience around yourself. And we basically say that it's like, while it's true that, you know, you absolutely need to be out there in sort of like the bookstore supply business, as Richard put it, you know, making sure that you're visible in that arena, it is also very useful for you to be, you know, to have this sort of like private's maybe the wrong word, but this sort of like niche community that you can build up around. And once you have people in, you can communicate directly with them. And, you know, rather than try to find them the next time that you have a book, you have them there and you can say like, oh, hey, you know that author you liked? He's got something new. Or, you know, you're really interested in books about knitting or about political or about politics. We've got something new in that category.
Right. And what's fascinating about the apps, and in the case of Electric Literature, it is a periodical, so they have an excuse for updating, but one can imagine all manner of excuses to update the app and to provide new information. But it really does strengthen that whole notion of what a brand is. In my definition, a brand is the commitment the company makes to the customer. Mm-hmm. And once you've got that app on their phone or on their tablet, wherever it may be, you can start to really strengthen that commitment.
Right. You know, like Andy and Scott had found that, you know, thousands of people downloaded the Electric Literature issue number one app. And then when they published the Electric Literature number two app, they found that they really didn't have a way to tell everybody who had gotten issue, you know, issue number one about issue number two. So they had to start, you know, they had to kind of scramble and find all those people again online to notify them. And one of the great features about the Electric Publisher software is that it essentially creates a, not so much a single ebook app as a bookshelf app. That it is its sort of its own sort of like proprietary e-reader in a sense, and that so that you can continue to funnel new content to it, and whether you have an RSS feed or you're using push notifications, you can alert readers to that new content as you develop it.
Right. It's really great. If you haven't, I suggest you take a look at the website for Electric Literature, electricliterature.com. Great things happening. And one of the commitments that Scott and Andy made from the very beginning was that they were going to pay their authors. This was important. So as much as this is from that experimental fringe of things, it's from publishers and authors who have a commitment to monetizing this.
Absolutely.
All right. Ron Hogan, thank you very much. And finally, I want to turn to Mark Coker. We've been letting Mark have a rest from the first session, although I expect that even if you are on allergy medicines or just coming off a red eye or whatever it is, you're going to keep on talking anyway, Mark. Welcome. Mark is CEO of Smashwords.
Ambien.
Ambien. He's got a lot to say about a lot of different things, and I want to cut to something that you didn't talk about in the first session that would, I think, be very important for the audience to hear, and that is your own experience to date with the Apple versus Amazon debate. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a really big question. Where do you want me to start?
Well, first of all, iBookstore got kind of swatted away. As much as everybody loves the iPad and loves whatever Steve Jobs does, there's been a sense in the publishing community that the iBookstore can be dismissed easily, and you don't.
Okay, yeah, I think the people who are dismissing Apple and the iBookstore are smoking opium. So at Smashwords, we are one of currently five authorized aggregators, which is a fancy word for distributor, serving the Apple iBookstore. We had about 2,000 books on the iPad in their bookstore on day one when they first shipped the iPad. We're now distributing close to 40,000 books to Apple. I'm very pleased with the sales of our books through the Apple iBookstore and how it's been trending. We had this huge spike over the holidays, and then just in the last couple months, we surpassed that spike. So I like the way the chart's going up. Some interesting data. Apple operates different iBook stores around the world, and they report the sales individually to us. The U.S. is obviously the biggest market, but Canada, U.K. are big. They're in Germany, France, Australia. We're getting about 50% of our sales outside of the U.S., which to me is really exciting because most of the markets outside of the U.S. are still not at the same place along the market share growth curve that we've had. You know, we've been going exponential here in the U.S., and some of the other countries are following right behind us. And so what that tells me, in the next couple years, as the rest of the world catches up to where we are today, we're going to see an explosion in revenue opportunity for authors who take a worldwide view of the marketplace.
Well, I think that's an important point. In the future of reading, the future of e-reading is going to, you know, people are going to find their customers not in this room, not in this state, not in this country, but in India or Africa or places across the globe.
Yes, definitely. We're seeing that. So as Apple rolls out more stores, we'll see more revenues. And some of these markets are arguably very small, but they're all additive to your bottom line.
And the important point is you could never reach those markets with a bookstore. But yet when someone is holding a smartphone in their hand, they've just about got a bookstore in their hand.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a transformational thing if you think about it. Many U.S. publishers, you know, tend to think very U.S.-centric. You produce your book, and then you sell off the rights to other geographic regions around the world. You go to London or Frankfurt, and you sell off the rights. Well, with e-books, you know, we're working primarily with self-published authors and hundreds of independent presses. And when you publish a book at Smashwords, you're giving us non-exclusive worldwide rights. So these books are going worldwide. You're not constrained by the old-fashioned geographic limitations of traditional publishers. So it is literally possible to upload and publish a book today in the U.S. and sell it to someone in India. At Smashwords.com, India is our number four source of traffic, which was kind of a surprise, but maybe not really. They've got maybe close to 1 billion English-speaking people. The growth in literacy is not happening here in the U.S. It's happening elsewhere.
Can I interject there? Just to say that the reverse is also true, that if I were an English language publisher in India or if I were a publisher in Australia, I would seriously look very strongly at retaining global rights and, you know, getting rid of the barrier of entry of publishing those books in America, you know, dealing with the printing costs. And, you know, printing them, you know, publishing them exclusively, I would totally, as an Indian or Australian publisher, work into the American market that way.
That's a great point.
Well, you know, I think the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, we said it was a debate. We've had one already this morning, Apple versus Amazon. Very briefly, Mark, because we want to give some time for some questions. Where do you stand right now, Smashwords, that is, with Amazon? Any updates on that?
Yes, we first signed a distribution agreement with Amazon about a year and a half ago. And as of today, we're only distributing about 20 books to them. We have about 35,000 that we'd love to send them. After Apple introduced the agency model to the world, it caused a lot of dislocation in the marketplace. We were distributing to some retailers on the wholesale model and some under the agency model. It was causing conflict. Some of our authors who publish independently at Amazon were getting penalized when, you know, a book at Barnes & Noble or Sony was discounted. Amazon was price matching. So we went to Amazon and said, look, you know, we have this agreement with you to distribute our books under the wholesale model, but that doesn't work for us anymore because of what you guys are doing on DTP. We'd like the agency model. And Amazon said no. Amazon hates the agency model, despite the fact that all of our other retail partners, including Kobo and, you know, Barnes & Noble and Sony, have given us agency terms. Amazon doesn't. So what we're working with them now is to, and it's, we're really just waiting for them to do it.
Yeah, just for everybody in the audience, I guess it probably takes more than the minute we have left for Mark, but if you could put it on a bumper sticker, Mark, agency versus wholesale.
On a bumper sticker, at agency, the author or publisher sets the price of the book, and under wholesale, the retailer can discount the book.
Could you repeat that, please? Closer to the mic.
Under agency? Oh, baby. Under agency, the author or the publisher sets the price of the book, so the retailer does not discount it. So the retailer is acting as an agent, selling the book on your behalf at the price that you set. Under the wholesale model, the retailer has the ability to discount the book. So that's the big difference. They're both wonderful models. I'm a supporter of both. The problem is it's difficult for a distributor such as us or a publisher to straddle both worlds. You can't straddle both worlds at the same time. So what we did is we worked with our retail partners to transition them all over to agency. So now we're not signing distribution agreements with our partners unless we get agency or agency-like terms. So we want those same terms with Amazon. The solution that we found is that their digital text platform, now called Kindle Direct. So we're waiting for them to create a bulk upload capability so that we can upload 35,000 books to them all at once and then automate the weekly updates and price changes and additions and removals that we're doing already with all of our other retail partners. So if all goes well, by the end of this year, we'll be distributing to Amazon. If they delay us, and I wouldn't be surprised if they do, then it might be longer.
All right. Well, thank you for that update, Mark Coker from Smashwords. And again, I want to give an opportunity to the audience here to ask a question or two in the couple of minutes we have left. So questions for members of the panel. Yes, here.
Well, Mark, are you, in your model, are you guys going to incorporate more graphic-centric works? And is there anyone that does that well and economically?
And in fact, I might ask everybody to try to chime in on that, about the whole notion of incorporating graphics into works, moving beyond text. Amy said that probably video, we're not quite ready for prime time there, but we may be moving beyond text. Mark, is there an experience there?
Sure. For those not familiar with the Smashwords platform, the way it works is you upload a Microsoft Word document formatted to the requirements in our Smashwords style guide, and then we convert that document into 9 different ebook formats. So we do support images and graphics in the ebooks, but we don't support animation.
Amy, how does that work for Kobo these days?
Yeah, so within our apps, we support color and graphics as well, and we're looking at how we can expand that. One of the challenges, and I think it's sort of an interesting discussion point, is a lot of people who create color content are uncomfortable with it being sent to an e-ink reader, which would take the color out of it. So there are a lot of people who are controlling that very tightly, and I'm actually of two minds about it personally. I mean, on the one hand, I think, well, if you're creating a beautiful color comic like Dark Horse Comics or something like that, I can understand the desire to keep control of that color and to want the reader to be able to experience it that way. And then the retailer side of me sort of says, like, well, someone's purchased this content. Who are you to say where they read it or how they use the content once they've got it in their hands? So it's an interesting conversation that we're having. But we certainly want to move towards color content in children's, in cookbooks. You know, we want to be able to have that in all of our apps.
James, some things for you to follow there, I think. He's taking notes, I see. We have time for one more question in the back.
I should also add that the Electric Publisher app does support not only color graphics, but also embedded or streaming audio or video. The trick there, as Amy mentioned much earlier, being to integrate it into the content in a way that is holistic rather than intrusive.
It's right. A different kind of editing.
I mean, right. In the back there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, I should have been more specific. The $4.99 released specifically for self-pubbed authors and people who are putting their stuff up directly. We also have another sales spike around $12.99, which is where most of the agency books fall.
Which probably accounts, James, for the $6.30 average there. And it's interesting to see where the pressure is going to come over the next 12 months as more self-published authors are able to try to sort of price it wherever they want to go. Mark, perhaps 30 seconds on that.
It's interesting. I think the reason the big publishers like agency is because they can control the price and prevent the discounting. But the reason self-published authors like agency is because they can offer a lower price but yet earn 60 to 70% of the retail price right. as their royalty. So the average book at Smashwords is under $5, even though we're agency.
Right. It's an interesting irony of a battle that was really fought for the really big publishers. I really appreciate everyone's attention for this program, our second Imagination session, what's new and what's next in e-reading. I want to thank our panelists, Amy Greco from Kobo, Ron Hogan, Electric Literature, Mark Coker from Smashwords, and James Howard from R.R. Belker. My name's Chris Keneally. Thank you very much.